Hi, and welcome to this weekend's Macro Call, hosted by myself, Adam Crook, and my partner, Mark Wilson. Kicking this off this week, Sir Alex Younger, former head of MI6 and GS senior advisor, discussing the main takeaways from the NATO Leaders Summit this week to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the alliance and setting out a potential framework for geopolitics and international affairs into year end. We then have David Merrickle reflecting on last week's CPI and Powell's testimony to Congress, and distilling how policy communication could evolve into Jackson Hole in the US. Richard Ramsden then follows up with the main takeaways from Friday's US bank earnings and what to watch from the financials reporting season. Richard Chambers discusses rates pricing and views moving into the autumn. We then ask Hui Shan whether we should expect anything from China's third plenum next week and how policymakers in China can possibly turn around the ever-weakening trend in Chinese growth and inflation. And finally, Tim Moe deconstructs the Nikkei's move to record highs, positioning, drivers, and how we should contextualize FX risk in the trade. As always, I would just like to remind everyone that this call is for GS clients only. If there are any non-clients or members of the press on the line, please do hang up now. And for our first slot, Sir Alex Younger, former head of MI6, and as mentioned on the intro before, senior advisor to Goldman Sachs. Alex, thanks for joining us always. So NATO leaders met for the 75th anniversary summit earlier this week amid rising tensions across the globe. What were the key takeaways from the summit in your view?
Well, I think it went all right under the circumstances. Ukraine was clearly top of the bill. Expectations were running pretty high. But the reality is that the war in Ukraine has moved on from a military conflict to a capability logistics and conflict to political will, which kind of goes bigger than NATO. So the slightly inconclusive conversations, which were basically designed to indemnify the aid program against Trump, were inconclusive, but they were all right. But in my view, more or less, are the least important issue. The military physics of the conflict is such that I think we are in a situation of pretty well perennial conflict. I don't expect either side to break through. That's a problem for the Russians. It's a problem for Zelensky as well, who needs, I think, to modify his theory of victory. But the issue is really around staying power and Putin's conviction that we don't have the patience, which may well be vindicated. So I think this leaves us contemplating two scenarios which are heavily dependent on the outcome of the November election. I think if it's Trump, he will try and end the war on day one, as he said he will. I think that what he's likely to be able to offer may not be enough for Vladimir Putin, though. So I don't think it automatically means surrender. My experience of Trump, which in this space is reasonably extensive, is he's an opportunist. It's about what makes Trump look good. And if he, I think if he feels Putin's falling short of going along with the plan, then you could see some quite surprising outcomes. So I hesitate to make predictions about that, but clearly people are worried about Trump and his evident oversimplification of the problems that exist. And if it's not Trump, if it's a Democrat, I think we see sustained stalemate in the capability space. I think the reason this war's gone on such a long time is, roughly speaking, that Chinese support for Russia is balancing out US support for America. But I think, in a sense, I expect that balance to continue with no early resolution of the Ukraine conflict. Europe, of course, is going Putin's way. It's interesting to see the amount of resources, disinformation resource he put into the French election, which may well be rewarded, of course. But it seems to me, in many ways, I'm slightly depressed by the outcome in France, because in a sense, I think it works well for Le Pen, who has increased her profile and power without actually having to take any responsibility for the ensuing chaos. But at least it means that Macron is at least nominally in charge up until 27. So I think you won't see the same degree of leadership from France or conviction in Europe. But broadly, I think they stay the course on Ukraine. So my sort of broad takeaway is that we see pretty well steady state into the medium term in Ukraine, which is not great news, but I suppose it could be worse. The thing that I'm interested in this month, and indeed for the next few months, is quite prosaic and a bit nerdy, but the third plenum is about to take place in China. This is traditionally the plenum which gets sets out the next 5 years of economic policy in China, and it's where some of the most important innovations in the past, including, of course, most importantly, the reform and opening up agenda, have been launched. And I think this really, really matters to us as human beings, as global citizens, and as investors, because the issue of whether she's prepared to blink and return to a more liberal economic path, I think, is fundamental to global economic growth prospects. And I would say that all of the mute music around the third plenum is that that's not going to happen, and that he's going to continue rather unimaginatively to prioritize control over growth and suck up the consequences, both through even deeper surveillance of his citizens and a slightly quixotic feel that he can produce even more stuff and export even more to get through this problem, together with a few blandishments. And common prosperity is a means of buying people off through a more redistributive agenda. I think this doesn't get the attention that it deserves. We've kind of got used to this idea, but in practice, I think that represents a really significant headwind to Chinese growth into the future. So I'm not going to talk to the cyclical factors. I think my economist colleagues are a better place to do that. But I think that fundamentally we're looking at a China that's making a set of choices that are going to make it the biggest economy in the world, but in no way the richest. And I think we're only starting now to think through the implications of that. Finally, from a sort of hard power geopolitical perspective, I think I'm most focused on the picture of Vladimir Putin hugging Kim Jong-un in Pyongyang. And when I look at, you know, the strands of isolationism that we see in Washington in particular, I'm keen that there's a better understanding of the interconnectivity between these various problems. And I find rather crass the narrative in Washington that they're spending too much time on Ukraine at the expense of their real strategic priorities in, say, the Pacific and on China. And I think that picture tells you that that's not a sufficiently sophisticated analysis. Kim is now, having been isolated and kind of the nutter, the sort of mad aunt in the attic of global politics, is now a member of a proper grown-up strategic alliance involving real trade-offs and military interdependencies. He's provided a year's worth of ammunition to Putin. And my question is, what is he getting in return? So I predict that it is going to get more bumpy in the Pacific, in the Western Pacific. I think I don't know what's going to happen next, but I think that he will be significantly emboldened by all of this. And when you set that alongside the, you know, extraordinary conflict over a reef that is usually submerged off the Philippines, I think it's going to be a bumpy autumn. And in fact, I think these issues are more significant than what we're seeing in Taiwan. So I hope that's enough to keep us cheerful, Adam.
Thank you, Sir Alex. That was good. And especially on the third plenum, you know, Hui Shan's going to be joining later in the call to talk through the economic side of things. But that's
You're ahead of me. That's excellent.
That's a good flag. That's a very good flag on the just the general kind of policy. So, you know, very good outline and framework there about, you know, the challenges we're looking at right now and the takeaways from the NATO summit. You know, as we look forward into the second half of the year and at the end of the year, and you mentioned the US election before, on the geopolitical front and in the sphere of international affairs, what are you most focused on? And in the context of elections, you know, what implications do you think they will have going forward?
Well, I think, I mean, naturally, given where I am, Europe figures pretty large. And I'm worried because Europe faced some really significant and deep problems in the innovation space, in the energy space, in the demographic space. And, you know, calling me a sort of metropolitan liberal, if you like, but it seems to me that the answer in all those areas is more focused and concerted action and teamwork at the European level. And the tide is really going out on that. I think European citizens, by and large, can't understand where the growth is going to come from and how their lives are going to be made better by the sort of exponents of the political consensus. And they're reaching for extremes. And this is catnip to Putin. So even if the sort of chaos in France has fallen short of our worst nightmare, I think we've got to understand that that lack of consensus is going to come at a really significant geopolitical cost and start to think of ways of working around that.
Thank you very much for joining us and for your comments, Sir Alex. Next, we're going to bring in David Merrickle, our chief US economist. David, we had a pretty pivotal CPI on Thursday. How did the data compare to your expectations, and what were your key takeaways?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. It was indeed another very soft report with just 6 bps on the core. That's a lot less than we were expecting. The big downside surprises were the 5% decline in airfares and the large declines in the shelter categories. Broadly, I see two big themes here. First, ongoing payback in categories where supply-demand imbalances raised relative prices during the pandemic, like used cars or perhaps travel. And second, the continued fading of what we've called catch-up inflation in categories like shelter and car insurance as the catch-up comes to an end. So while the June number was certainly an exaggeration of the downward trend, these are themes that should continue to keep inflation pretty soft through the rest of the year. We do expect core PCE to be higher than usual relative to core CPI because not all the soft categories in CPI flow through to PCE, and because we think residual seasonality originating largely from the PPI inputs to PCE will boost core PCE by about 5 bps in June. Next month in the July data, OER should be soft again because we should see payback with a 6-month lag for the January spike, and because residual seasonality on core PCE should turn modestly negative again. So all of that means we're lining up to have a string of good inflation reports. For the Fed, I think this should make a September cut easier. I think both the market and some Fed officials have been overreacting a bit to noise in the inflation data all year, both noise from residual seasonality and just the inevitable noise and idiosyncrasies that you always get in the inflation numbers. Our take has been that already by the fall of 2023, the labor market had rebalanced back to pre-pandemic norms, inflation expectations had normalized. So at that point, the inflation problem was really solved. I suspect Powell's on the same page, but he's had a lot of skeptical colleagues to contend with. And I think the latest couple months of inflation data should make those conversations a lot easier and pave the way to a September cut. I'd also say that the soft inflation reports make it even easier for them to cut more aggressively than 25 bps every meeting if needed. I don't think inflation would be the main reason for that, but the unemployment rate has risen a fair bit, and Powell's tone on that has changed over the last couple of weeks. I think everyone agrees that at a minimum, you wouldn't want the rise in the unemployment rate to go any further. Our best guess is that it won't, but if it does, I think that could easily merit a more aggressive response, and the market's right to start to put some partial weight on that possibility.
Thanks, David. On the Fed specifically, we had a decent amount more Fed speak, specifically the congressional testimony. What did you learn from Chair Powell, and has that impacted, if at all, your expectations and forecasts now for the Fed?
Yeah, Powell spoke at the ECB forum last week and then twice before Congress this week. So here's my big takeaway. Previously, the FOMC seemed to be, if anything, downplaying the increase in the unemployment rate. They raised their Nehru estimate twice, which I found odd. And Powell had said at previous Fed meetings that unemployment would have to rise more than they expected for them to see it as a problem to react to. But over the last 2 weeks, Powell highlighted risks to the labor market. He emphasized that unexpected weakening there could prompt the Fed to cut, kind of separately from inflation. And he said that the labor market has cooled pretty significantly and had seen considerable softening. So now there's a second reason to cut, and it sounds to me like Powell is going to be a bit more willing to push other Fed officials to cut if they need pushing. I think that's entirely appropriate. The unemployment rate is, after all, up 0.7 percentage points from the bottom, or 0.5 percentage points on a 3-month average basis. And while Powell is right that it's still quite low by historical standards, I don't think the increase was necessary to solve what's left of the inflation problem. And the increase so far is, after all, 1 million extra people who are now unemployed. So it does deserve some attention. I think everyone basically agrees that we don't want it to go further at a minimum. And while I wouldn't necessarily expect it to get any worse from here on its own, and I don't know that Fed officials do either, I also don't see any reason to take any risks. So I agree that this has become you know, or is on the verge of becoming a legitimate second reason to cut. All of this just makes me more confident that the Fed will go ahead and deliver the first cut in September. We have the better inflation news they wanted. We have a second reason to cut from an increase in the unemployment rate. And it sounds like the chair is more willing to push the committee toward cutting if need be.
And one final one for you, David. Do the Jackson Hole Fed conferences just around the corner, really, reassessing the effectiveness and transmission of policy is the working title. What are your views on that topic? And what do you think, if anything, may come out of that that is new and meaningful for the market?
Yeah, it sounds like the Jackson Hole theme is motivated by the question of why 525 bips of rate hikes didn't cause a recession. I think there are three main reasons for that, three main answers to that question. Yeah, first, very simply, the starting level of demand was very high. Second, there are other powerful non-monetary policy forces that also affect the economy. And a couple of them have been big tailwinds this cycle that offset the negative impact of higher rates. Namely, we have much wider than usual fiscal deficits and have had surprisingly resilient risk sentiment, which has limited the transmission from higher rates to tighter broad financial conditions. But then the third reason, and this is closest to the Jackson Hole theme, the impact of rate hikes was dampened in some respects and delayed in others this cycle. This idea that monetary policy has had less impact on the economy per 100 basis points of hikes due to some big idiosyncrasies of this cycle, that's actually been a big theme of our research over the last 2 years. One big example of this that I think is important is that what are usually the two most rate-sensitive sectors, housing and autos, they were both supply constrained and started the hiking cycle with excess demand. So reducing demand there has had much less impact than usual on economic activity. Another example of this is that some of the normal effects of higher rates on interest expense and ultimately spending have been smaller this time. Few households have adjustable rate mortgages these days. Corporates issued a huge amount of debt and termed it out just before rates went up. And the biggest net debtor in our economy, the federal government, is looking at a large rise in its interest expense, but so far it's not really chosen to cut back on its spending in response. So I suspect these are the kinds of themes that will be explored at Jackson Hole. How does monetary policy transmit to the economy? And can initial conditions unique to each cycle amplify or diminish the impact of, say, 100 basis points of rate hikes? Now, that's mostly a backward-looking question, but one related forward-looking question is whether the forces that diluted the impact of rate hikes would also dilute the impact of future rate cuts. In some cases, I think the answer is yes. So for example, if most people already have a very low mortgage rate locked in, then lowering rates initially is not going to allow many homeowners to refinance and save money and spend more. So one implication of monetary policy perhaps being less effective now in both directions is that if something went wrong, they might have to cut a bit more forcefully to get the usual impact.
Thank you very much, David. Our next speaker is Richard Ramsden. Richard is Business Unit Leader of the Financials Research Group. Richard, regulation has really dominated a lot of the conversation around large cap US banks year to date, but we're now getting into the guts of reporting season. We had the three large banks report on Friday. Just looking at that initial take on earnings, can you give us your first thoughts, both micro and macro observations from those results, please?
Yeah, so look, I would say the focus is really on four key things. The first is, you know, what's happening around loans and deposits. Loan demand continues to be pretty weak outside of credit card lending. So C&I loan growth is still negative, as is commercial real estate loan growth. I think the view there is it will continue to remain pretty tepid until you see rate cuts, which obviously is not going to be until later on this year. Around deposits, I think the good news is that you are seeing stabilization in terms of deposit flows. Deposits for most of these banks really haven't moved that much quarter to quarter. But you are still seeing some funding pressure, especially for banks with low-cost funding. You know, so if you look at Wells Fargo in particular, a lot of the disappointment there was around net interest income, And that was really, I think, because they did see deposit costs increase 10 basis points from Q1 to Q2, which was more than most of their peers, but their funding costs are just coming from a much, much lower level. The third thing is there's a focus on investment banking activity and trading activity. That continues to be pretty robust. The narrative around primary capital markets in particular continues to get more constructive, with banks pointing to a reopening of ECM markets, as well as pipelines and M&A building, with the election in November potentially being a catalyst, especially if there's a change in administration. And then lastly, credit trends are obviously very important. The good news here is you are seeing stabilization of credit trends broadly. Banks are really only adding to reserves to fund loan growth, with the only real pressure point continuing to be low-end consumers, who obviously have seen the biggest impact from inflation.
Thank you, Richard. And then more broadly, what are your thoughts on what should we expect as we go through bank reporting season? And is there a differing narrative you'd expect to hear from small and mid-cap US banks?
Yeah, so I think, look, from here on, I think the focus is going to continue to be really on two things. The first is the inflection of net interest income growth, especially in the light of potential rate cuts now happening earlier in the year. A lot of investors are expecting that Q2 is going to be the trough point for net interest income, and that you are going to see growth in net interest income in the second half of the year. I do think, if anything, the prospects of rate cuts happening earlier is going to be a greater positive for some of these regional banks that do actually have more expensive funding bases, some of these than these large banks. And then I think, look, the second thing is going to continue to be on the potential for regulatory change if there is a change in administration in November. Clearly, that has contributed to some of the rally that you've seen in some of the large banks. It hasn't really had much of an impact in terms of valuations on some of the regional banks. But I do think there is going to be a lot of focus around whether or not some of the proposed rule set changes around capital and liquidity could change, and whether or not it could change the environment for M&A in particular and lead to premier consolidation coming back.
Thank you, Richard. Let me bring in our next speaker, who's Richard Chambers. Richard is Global Head of Repo Trading and Global Co-Head of Short Macro Trading. Rich, there were some reasonable market moves this past week, really catalyzed by both the CPI print and then the more dovish commentary from Chair Powell, and specifically his comments with regard to the labor market. What were your takeaways from the inflation data, Powell's commentary, and then also the market reaction?
Thanks for having me here this evening. You know, the inflation print today highlighted the recent favorable inflation prints for the Fed. We went into the data print with a 70% probability of a September cut. That is now almost at 100 basis points. And given the length of time between now and then, it looks like the market will stay here, or if not, the risk is now it may price in more as we have more, you know, significantly more data between now and the September FOMC. Interesting, you know, there is more and more debate as to whether, you know, the Fed should even act earlier, as in the end of July. The market is pricing in a 10% probability. Low, whilst we don't think they will cut in July, there will be more and more scrutiny on the Fed as to why they're not going and why they're not cutting rates so soon. But I think it tees up nicely the data and solidifies the September cut, a change of projections to two, if not three cuts in 2024. We think it's sufficient clarification of progress on inflation. And, you know, we think that, you know, whilst the market went in anticipating a weaker print, you know, and position was quite long front end delta in dollar rates, the positions were justified today based on the print.
Thanks, Rich. Obviously, one of the key stories, maybe the key story of the first 6 months of the year, was the pricing out of Fed cuts. given how the data is shaping up now, what are your key views as we head into the second half of the year, and what are you most focused on as we go through summer?
You know, we have 60 basis points now priced into the end of the year. We have another just over 100 basis points in 2025. You know, the market is well priced. And the key question now is, do they cut rates quicker? You know, cumulatively, you could argue that at 3.5% at the end of 2025, there's a fair amount of weak data priced into the curve. Rates right now are restrictive. You know, what is the definition of non-restrictive rates? You know, time will tell, and we think it will be data dependent. But for now, we think the value, you know, is pricing it is really the Fed going somewhat quicker than the market prices, as opposed to the cumulative amount into 2025. As we obviously approach the election as well, you know, the market is trying to place probability distributions to a clean sweep by the Republican Party, different presidential outcomes, you know, the potential risk of tariffs into 2025, which should put somewhat a cap on how much we can price into, you know, late 25, early 2026 rates and further out the curve. However, you know, as bias changes and as the Fed enter into a cutting cycle, you will see new flow of funds into the bond market. You know, the backdrop is quite supportive, the treasury market here. Certainly trade, you know, as the fear factor is quite high on quantitative tightening, on the amount of treasury issuance in the pipeline. And we certainly will, we think that the data this week and Chairman Powell's commentary is supportive carry structures for the near term. In particular, treasury asset swaps, whilst we, you know, the stronger dollar trade, which has worked so well over the last 6 months, will come under some pressure, especially in G10. And we saw that in the price action this week in dollar yen. So all in all, you know, the market is pricing in a lot cumulatively, but there's a risk that the Fed could move quicker. Instead of every quarter, they could go to every meeting in the first half of 2025. And that's where we see potentially the value, however forward rates seem to be quite fair here at, you know, below 3.5%.
Thanks. And for the next section, we've got Hui Shan, our chief China economist. Hui, thanks for joining. So China's third plenum is right around the corner amid weak growth, a downbeat market and investors in search of a stimulus. Can you first give us some background on the third plenum? What is it and why is it important?
Sure. The third plenum happens once every 5 years in China and is mainly focusing on economic reforms for the coming years, at least in the next 5 years. So you can imagine, given the Chinese system where policymakers control a lot of tools, investors are very much interested in hearing their plan for economic reforms in the coming years. Remember the 1978, a long time ago, 1978 third plenum was the turning point for China to start opening up its market and to do fundamental reforms and really unleashed growth potential for the following decades. So from that point of view, not every third plenum is as important as the 1978 third plenum, but it has the potential to be important.
Thanks, Hui. As you said, policymakers will outline their economic reform plans. What are the key things that need to be addressed in your view? And how do you see policymakers tackling these issues?
For this particular third plenum, if we think about what kind of problems the Chinese economy is facing right now, and then think about what policymakers may do to address these problems, that's the framework we're thinking about. So thinking of the big housing downturn and the risk it's creating in the financial system and for local governments, I think the number one question for the third plenum is to address local government financing. Now that local governments cannot rely on land sales for a major source of revenue, what are they going to do on the economic reforms front to rebalance local government finances on a sustainable basis going forward. So it could be reforms in terms of a central government borrowing more and leveraging so that they can transfer resources to local governments. It could be also discussions about, for example, consumption tax. Right now, all the consumption tax revenue goes to central government, and we have heard and news reports have also been discussing that the third plenum may be a venue at which policymakers talk about allocating consumption tax to local governments. And also over the long run, if local governments is getting revenue from consumption, then their incentive is to increase consumption activity in their jurisdiction. So over the long term, this could be a very important and useful tool to provide that rebalancing in financing needed for local governments. And that could be an important reform agenda. Although in the near term, just given how weak consumer sentiment is, we expect the process and implementation to be slow. And another major question sort of on everyone's mind is what is going to drive China's growth going forward? In the past few decades, we had this spectacular growth driven by property, driven by infrastructure building. But as urbanization entering sort of a slower mode, what is the driver of growth for China? And here we think policymakers may have reform agendas on the technology, innovation, high-end manufacturing front, and also in terms of urban-rural development, regional development, land policy, hukou system. That entire complex of potential reforms are also going to be important. The basic idea is that China is still a developing country with a major rural area. If you can move labor capital from unproductive rural area to more productive urban centers, that's your source of growth and productivity. So that's another area we think could imply some interesting reform agenda for the coming years. So to summarize, we think both containing the left tail risks triggered by the housing downturn and figuring out what's the driver of growth in the coming years will be the key agenda for this third plenum.
Thanks. And final question, Kui, with reference to, you know, recent conversations you've had with clients, how are clients positioned into this event? What are their expectations? And ultimately, what implications will it have on the market in your view?
Interestingly, in our client conversations, both onshore and offshore, I would say expectations are pretty low, especially among the onshore clients. I think especially because we interact with the financial sector and China is doing a round of staff cutting and salary controls for the financial sector. So sentiment is weak and expectations are certainly quite low. In addition, because in 2013, in the 2013 third plenum, the government set they were going to implement a full set of a reform agenda, but nothing really quite come to fruit. So that's another reason why expectations are low, that even if government say that they're going to do some useful reforms, they may or may not be able to implement it. On the other hand, because expectations are so low, it could surprise us to the upside if the third plenum does introduce very market-friendly reform agendas. And one more thing I want to add is that this coming week we're going to have the third plenum, which happens once every 5 years. But end of this month, end of July, we're also going to have the July Politburo meeting. That is important because that's every year in end of July, government will be thinking about economic management for the second half of the year. So that's another important event for investors potentially hearing from the government about, are they going to do more to ease the property market and support the property market and to curtail the downside risks coming from the that part of the economy? And what's the plan for the government, especially as we head into U.S. election season and the risk of tariffs is rising? What are the plans for macro policy, monetary, fiscal, industrial, any tone changes in terms of macro economic management? So I think that's another upcoming catalyst that investors may want to keep an eye on.
Thanks, and for the final slot, we have Tim Mo, Chief Asia Pacific Regional Equity Strategist and co-head of Macro Research in Asia. Tim, thanks for joining. So Nikkei breaking out, reaching all-time highs, and you know, turning heads internationally. What's driving this leg higher, and what does positioning look like?
So the Nikkei and now the topics have reached all-time highs. Topic just took out its late 1989 high. A week or so ago. And I think it's important for investors to understand the context that we had a very, very strong first quarter where Topix was up 17% in local currency terms. And then it basically traded sideways in Q2, kind of working off some of that overheatedness technically, and then effectively allowing underlying earnings to catch up with that very, very strong market move. And now having set that base, the market's now broken above those all-time highs, and it's up 3%. For month-to-date in July. I think the fundamentals here are that we've actually had very strong earnings delivery for full-year fiscal 23, which ends in March of 2024. Earnings are up about 18%, and there have been positive revisions. So definitely the underlying fundamentals of earnings coming through, which is a function partly of the weaker yen and having currency translation gains, but also just underlying strong growth. And I think a lot of that's also powered by the improved bottom-up corporate performance, which is a function of the Tokyo Stock Exchange efforts to get companies to improve their returns on equity and return cash to shareholders. So you've got a stronger earnings base. That passage of time and that sideways correction meant that valuation, which had gotten a bit stretched at over 15 times, corrected to about 14 and a half. And so I think that intersection between compressed valuation and underlying earnings growth and an expectation on a forward basis of about 10% EPS growth for this year and next, really set the stage for the market to break out in the way that it's been done.
Thanks, Tim. And, you know, while the Nikkei has rallied, yen has obviously weakened substantially, eroding performance in dollar terms, especially versus the NASDAQ or S&P. You know, how does this FX headwind affect your outlook?
The yen is really the topical issue here. And I think it's important to note two numbers. The year-to-date performance of Topix is up 22% in local currency, but only 8% in U.S. dollars, given the very sharp depreciation of the Japanese yen. So this has had an impact on flows. Flows have been positive, about $29 billion U.S. dollars year-to-date. But hedge funds actually net sold a bit in June. They got down to a roughly 55th percentile of their five-year allocation. Mutual funds are still somewhat underweight. And there hasn't been as much pressure to add, even though we've had this break of the all-time highs, because in U.S. dollar terms, the S&P has still significantly outperformed U.S. dollar Japan performance. So I think all eyes are on the yen. Now, there's an interesting tension here because there's a very wide funding spread between U.S. dollars and Japanese yen, over 5% currently, and that's putting significant depreciation pressure on the yen and causing it to JPY level to move up well through the 160 level. Against that, however, is that in fundamental terms, the yen is the most undervalued it's been in over 30 years, really since the Plaza Accord in 1985. So you've got a tension between the near-term funding spreads versus the longer-term fair value. Now, the interesting turn of events here, of course, is that with the expectations for the Fed now to start easing, and our expectation is in September, that suggests that there may, in the coming months, start to be some narrowing of that funding spread. So there's a bit of a tension here where people who are using Japanese yen as a funding currency, expecting further depreciation, may see some pressure on that. And indeed, we saw some signs of a potential intervention by BOJ or else some concerns about carry trade with the yen appreciated from 161 back down to about 158, and then now has come back up and it's about the 159 level. As we speak. So I think there's a real tug of war at this level. Bottom line here is that in the near term, there still seems to be from the funding spread differential pressure on the upper side, and that could be perhaps resulting in some correction of the overall equity market. but looking out past the sort of 2 or 3 month window, then if the yen starts to stabilize and appreciate, that could bring renewed energy into the yen trade and get and also get more investors coming into the equity market. So we, bottom line, remain constructive on Japan, but certainly on a 6 to 12 month view, we think there's further upside driven by underlying earnings, still fair valuations, underlying bottom-up corporate change. And then I think one of the triggers for that could be stabilization of the exchange rate.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks to all our speakers today. And as always, thanks to all our clients for joining. We'll be back next weekend with another weekend macro call. Wishing everybody, all our clients, the best of luck in the markets next week. Thank you.